Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today from Kent, in one of my very favorite places, the United Kingdom, is Chris Slade. Chris is a legendary drummer going all the way back to the early 70s in the Manfred Mann Band, has been a big, big part of AC/DC in their story, two tenures with the band, now leads a phenomenal band, has got a great new album out, Timescape, the Chris Slade timeline. Fresh off a gig last night in France. I think you've been driving all day and night to get back to do this, so I appreciate it, Chris. We are thrilled to talk to yet another iconic drummer, so a heartfelt welcome to Great Minds.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to be here.
So, Chris, I'd love to go back to the Manfred Mann Earth Band, and you were one of the founding members. You played on eight of their legendary records, going all the way back to give or take 1972. You've played with everybody. We're going to touch on AC/DC, icons like Jimmy Page and Paul Rodgers when you played with the Firm. But let's go back and talk about those early remembrances, a young Chris Slade with Manfred Mann back in the early 70s.
Was that ever the case, the young Chris Slade? Anyway, I actually started with Tom Jones in the 60s. 1963, I turned professional with Tom. I was 16 years old, and he wasn't Tom Jones yet. His name was Tommy Woodward, and they were a very successful band in South Wales in a very small way, no records or anything, just doing the working men's clubs and things like that. I joined them in 63, as I said, and I immediately started earning more money than my father was making, working in a factory all day, which was not a lot of money. It's like $40 for a week.
Right. You know,
that was the average money back then. But it was steady work. We were working 4 or 5 nights a week. Tom was already an amazing singer, and everybody in South Wales, where we are from, knew that. Pontypridd in South Wales knew that he was a tremendous singer. Because we used to do Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and anything like that. And Tom could actually sing Little Richard stuff.
Wow.
Which not many people could do. They might have a stab at it, but they can't sing it like Little Richard, for instance. And we were jeans and leather jackets. We were a rock and roll band, and Tom was a rock and roll singer. But then he used to throw some ballads in also. Things like I Believe was a big song that he used to do, which is an old, old song. And it was tremendous. It got my feet under the door with playing drums professionally. And we ended up going to London when Gordon Mills, the songwriter manager, took Tom on with us. And our first gig in London, in the big city, was supporting the Rolling Stones. And
amazing.
That was their first, they just brought their first single out, which is a Chuck Berry song called Come On. We played a gig in Oxford Street in London, which is the big shopping thoroughfare, and it was a place called Tiles, and it was tiny, it was like it held 200 people. But
amazing.
That night it held 400 people, and you could not breathe on stage. They were throwing water on us to keep us from expiring, I think.
Oh my
God. A bit
God.
Like yourselves in New York.
Exactly. So I love that you took us all the way back to the very beginning. Let's talk about that era, 1963. You guys were rock and roll, but it was really early days for rock and roll. It had emerged from, Skiffle and some of the early acts. You know, Cliff Richard was around. But talk about, that you were really there at such an important time. The birth, really, of British rock and roll, roots going back to all the great American black blues artists.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, my listening career started in the 50s. So I go even further back with memory. And I had an elder brother, Danny, and I could play his record collection, which of course was Wax Records in those days, 78. And, there was Elvis Presley, Rock Around the Clock and all that stuff was around, and I had access to that. So I had a great musical education, really, right from the very start. And then everything started to change a bit, and rock and roll was sort of old-fashioned because people like the Stones and the Beatles were doing their own thing. And so rock and roll, which we were, Tom Jones and the Squires, were rock and roll. So we're a bit old-fashioned in our approach, although Tom was 22 and I was 16. We were so old fashioned.
Right.
But yes, we played with some of those blues guys too. John Lee Hooker was one, and did a show with him and a few other people like that. So we, of course, we knew about that, but Tom was very much into Jerry Lee. So that was our prime thing. But of course, we'd throw in some contemporary stuff also, you know, do a, maybe a Beatles song or something.
Right.
Certainly a Rolling Stones song when they started writing. This is before this gig I mentioned. It was before they'd even started writing together, Jagger and Richards. So that's why they brought out a Chuck Berry song. Because they didn't have any of their own.
Right.
Yeah.
And the clubs, you mentioned Tiles Marquee Club, so many other places that, you know, I think really the only one in London that's still left is the 100 Club from that era. But these places were hosting the biggest bands of the day.
Yeah, they were. The people, the guys, you know, the bands were just trying to do shows, earn some money, you know, including the Beatles and the Stones at that time. A real starting place, if you like, for the whole of, you know, for the rest of the world. And it came, the music came from America and went back to America by the Stones, various other people like that. So they re-imported it into America, especially the blues stuff.
And that's true of so many artists and so much music, including jazz music, where, you know, Miles Davis had to go to Paris to be treated respectfully as a musician and as a black man. What do you think that was, Chris, that across the board, the UK acts, you know, the Stones most famously, but the Kinks, the Who, so many of the other acts, the Yardbirds, and I know you did a lot of work with Jimmy Page, but they all got Muddy Waters and Son House and Robert Johnson, and you mentioned John Lee Hooker, and treated them with much more respect and affection in many ways than they were treated with back home in America.
Yes, I've read that many times, and I've seen it myself, of course, when because I started touring in America about 65. So, and I've been going there ever since. So it's funny, but, you know, you mentioned Manfred Mann's Earth Band. Manfred Mann himself came from South Africa, and he left South Africa because of apartheid. He could work with a black musician at night, but if he saw him on the street during the day, he could not talk to him because they'd probably both get arrested. So it's very strange, that segregation thing. When the guys used to do the circuit, when the black guys used to do the circuit, you know, on the bus, they'd have to sit at the back of the bus, for instance, which is disgusting, which is terrible. And different clubs, white clubs, black clubs, drinking water, taps in the street. You couldn't drink out of a tap in a park, for instance, if you were black. You know, it's just a terrible situation. And they weren't treated with respect at all. And they were kicking off the whole new sort of music, if you like, with blues, which is quite old. You know? And they kicked the Stones and the Beatles off. You know, they made them start, I mean, by just, you know, by just being and just playing what they loved, like the blues and that sort of thing. So a lot of musicians grew up listening to that, you know, the Beatles, I know, and the Stones, I know, that did that. And so did we. You know, we were listening to Little Richard and many others like him. So it's a strange world, shall I say.
Indeed. So you had this early run starting at age 16 with Tommy Woodward, later Tom Jones. Go to the States, you mentioned 1965. Was that with Tom?
Yeah, it was. So when I was 19, I played Madison Square Gardens for a week with Tom, and the Count Basie Orchestra with the band that was backing Tom, and I was playing drums.
Amazing. And talk about that run with Tom and then how you got hooked up with Manfred Mann.
After 7 years, I left Tom, and I got a phone call from Manfred Mann, and he said, would you like to get together, form a band? I said, yes, of course. And he said, do you know a bass player? I know a guitarist and singer in Australia, and he'll come over. Do you know a bass player? Which I did, which was Colin Pattenden, the guy who was the bass player for at least 5 years. And Colin says to me, you know, Manfred still hasn't said, this is the band. Oh, this is how the band, this is now going to be Manfred. Well, we didn't have a name to start with. We were called Manfred Mann, like the 60s Manfred Mann, which was a great detriment, actually, because everybody expected the pop group, and we were a sort of progressive band, earth band, and they didn't know what to expect from us. So in the beginning, it was very, very hard to get gigs with earth band, but we were more like Cream or something on stage. You know, Mick Rogers was, or still is, he's still with Manfred, is a great guitarist and singer. And so, you know, we all went off on musical tangents on stage, just like a jazz solo, coming back to the beginning or coming back to the hook or whatever, after somebody soloing for however long. So we, you know, we worked very well together. And that went on for at least 5-6 years, I think. And then, and Manfred was always getting, say, Bob Dylan songs or something for us to do. And then one day, when we were in the States, Manfred and I got given a Bruce Springsteen album, which had gone down the tubes, Greetings from Asbury Park. It's a multi-million seller now, but back then, nobody bought it when it first came out. And I thought Bruce Springsteen was a tremendous writer. But when we came back to Britain, we brought the albums with us, and I was telling everybody, like DJs, anybody who'd listen, you've got to listen to this writer, you know, because his lyrics are fantastic. And thankfully, it paid off. And Bruce has me to thank for his great success.
There you go. Yeah, not widely. You know, today, such an enormous star who's had such a wonderful, long, long career. You know, he's really one of the true icons of American music, certainly. We're going to see him in the E Street Band later in the summer. He's back on tour in Philadelphia, we're going. But it is true, though, and you raise a good point, the early albums, not only Greetings from Asbury Park, but for a while after that, it really wasn't until, I think, The River that he really blew up as a commercial artist. He struggled. You know, this odd dichotomy, people who knew music like you loved and respected him. He was on the cover of Time magazine at a very young age, cover of Rolling Stone magazine at a very young age, but didn't really do much commercially for quite a long time.
Right. Yeah, I said to Max Weinberg, you know, the drummer.
Sure.
I said, oh, he came to see The Firm one day, Jimmy Page and Paul Rodgers came to see The Firm, and we were backstage with Max. And I said, oh, Max, I thought I better tell you, I was the drummer on Blinded by the Light by Manfred's Earth Band. He said, oh, that record kept us going for a few years, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Great story. So talk about The Firm. Great, great run that you had with Jimmy Page and Paul Rodgers, two more icons of music. That was a great run also for you.
Yes. I mean, I was chuffed to death, which means in British, I was very pleased to be doing that. You know, it was an opportunity, you know, to play with, as you say, icons. And, you know, having been in the beginning with somebody with such a great voice as Tom Jones, and then, you know, 10 years later, another great voice in Paul Rodgers, it was fantastic. I'd met him a few times before that. And he was in Free the first time I met him. And they were a great band, but they were opening the show for Earth Band. And we were all both opening the show for Deep Purple, you know, in Australia. So, you know, it's strange. A great band like that were opening the show, you know. 1973, Kiss were opening the show for us, band, their first gig.
And Jimmy Page.
Jimmy Page is a really nice guy. Believe it or not, people think of him as like this god or something. He's not. He's a bloke. And, you know, at heart, he's a very ordinary bloke. And he, you know, he really is very nice. And we all got on well together. I never saw him once throw a tantrum, if you like, unless it was professional, you know, oh, we can't do that on the 21st or whatever, you know, something like that. But apart from that, he's very quietly spoken. You know, what can I say? Great guitarist, of course. And I'm a fan myself of Led Zeppelin, of course. Who isn't? Just wonderful stuff.
We had a great conversation on Great Minds a couple years ago with Jim McCarty from the Yardbirds, another great drummer. And people don't remember that at one point in the Yardbirds, all at the same time, you had Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, you know, all crossing over with each other. Just incredible.
Unbelievable. And no wonder the Yardbirds got such a great reputation, you know. And and Led Zeppelin was called the new Yardbirds to start with. And I was going to say something else then about that. Jeff Beck is probably, you know, He's one of the greatest guitarists ever born, you know. I know he's no longer with us, unfortunately. I've seen many concerts lately of him, you know, they are tremendous. But to have Pagey and Beck and Clapton all in, I remember at a show in London of the Firm, and Jimmy was really, really nervous. And like he says to the manager, that, look, I can't see anybody, okay? Because I'm just worried about this. So, and he got really worried. And then the manager came in and said, there's some people to see you, Jim. No, I don't see anybody. No, it's okay. It's just Jeff, Eric, and George. No. Hello, fellas. How are you? George Harrison, Jeff Beck, and Eric Clapton. And they all came in. And he was incredibly nervous before, but he wasn't nervous after seeing those guys.
Great stories. I want to talk about AC/DC. I want to get to the present day and the Chris Slade timeline. But some of the other names you work with, Chris, we have to ask about such a varied, incredible group. Did some work with David Gilmour.
Yes. He's a diamond of a bloke. He's one of the greatest guitarists around, of course. We all know that. And he does it live too. You know, it's no trickery with all the rest of it. And he's an unbelievably nice person. What you see is what you get. If you see him in an interview, that's how he is in real life. So, and he's very generous with his time and his money. He sold his London house for millions and gave it all to the homeless. So, you know, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's coming back touring in the States in the fall. And what about Olivia Newton-John?
She was okay. She was nice. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't famous at all in those days. And when I left Tom Jones after 7 years, I heard about this movie project that was going on. And a friend of mine put me forward for it. He happened to be the keyboard player in this movie project, and he played with Tom Jones. And they paid really well, as all movie projects do. And they'd already made the film. Livy and Vic had already made the movie. So I was just there to promote. And we rehearsed a few times, but we never did a show. And I knew she could sing in tune because I'd heard her a few times in rehearsals. But that's all I knew. I didn't know anything else. So it was really nice to know her.
Another great icon. So let's talk about AC/DC. You had two runs with the band going back to the 80s and then again more recently, working with the Young Brothers, with Angus and Malcolm, you know, another just incredible, incredible run and one of the biggest bands in the world.
Yes, even when I joined them first in 89, it was, I think, when I first joined, they, in my mind, they were one of the biggest bands in the world. And Cliff, the bass player, said to me, well, we're sort of down a little bit compared to what we usually do. You know, it's still good, but it's not as it was like 5 years ago. And he was being very honest there. He needn't have told me that, you know. So then after Razor's Edge album, they picked up again to godlike status with Thunderstruck. That was the big thing, of course.
And being on big tours with AC/DC, that must have been a little crazy.
You know, people say that. It's quite boring inside the band. Angus has never drunk alcohol in his life. Malcolm was had come off booze by that time. And Cliff and Brian were sort of ordinary drinkers, if you like, nothing over the top. As far as I know, I mean, I only say this because I never have. They didn't take drugs. You know, I don't know that for a fact because I didn't go home with them, you know. But everybody's got this idea that AC/DC are wild. Angus is wilder than anybody on stage, but only on stage. You know, he likes history and he's got a memory like an elephant. And he remembers all the dates and all the kings and queens and when the battles were and what they were about and all that. So he's a bit of a history buff, you know. So people hearing me say that and they think about, you know, they think of AC/DC and they think a bottle of Jack, you know, before I go to the concert, and couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, there you go, right from the inside. So, Chris, so many memories. And before we get to talk about Timescape, you know, when you look back on this incredible career going back, you were born just after World War II in 1946, started with Tom Jones when you were 16, then Tommy Woodward, as you said. Is there a particular memory or a particular artist that you work with that really stands out and rises above the rest? And in your memories, when you think of those moments that mean the most to you, I mean, you've played with so many incredible icons.
Yeah, I'm just grateful to play drums. Really, there's nothing that, so I can't bring anything. It's always really difficult to do something like this. Oh, tell us a joke. You can't think of a single joke, you know. Gilmore's year I was with Gilmore was really good in every respect. And respect is the word, because Dave had respect for the musicians in his band and vice versa. And we were all on a bus together, and sometimes he'd wake us up blasting heavy metal, and it was like 8 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
I used to laugh his socks off when he did that.
Oh my gosh. And let's talk about the current band. You've been together for 10 years. It's a great, great story. New album, Timescape, out, doing gigs, fresh off one last night in France. But talk about, you know, today and what's still going on in Chris Slade's life behind that drum kit.
The life, actually, of Chris Slade is behind a drum kit. And I hope it's going to be there for some time, because, you know, I used to do some stuff. I used to do a lot of martial arts, for instance. I don't anymore, except I do Tai Chi. I've done that for many years. I used to run a lot and don't do that anymore, because I can't. So, you know, it's getting a bit like with AC/DC now. It's a bit boring inside Chris Slade, you know. I live for playing drums, and that's a fact. I've got 3 children and 4 grandchildren. So I'm afraid it's a geezer after the drums go away. It's definitely an old geezer.
It's a wonderful life. And we didn't mention some of the other bands, Uriah Heep, Asia, who you were with for 6 years. It's been an incredibly charmed career behind that drum kit. And wishing you every success with Timescape. It's a great, great record. Any plans to come to the States, Chris?
I wish we did. I'd love to. It's just the visa thing. You've got to get a visa. I'm okay. I've got a green card, but the guys need visas. Otherwise, you can't work in the States. There's no other way to do it. And there's real horror stories about people. The visa shows up 2 months after their tour is supposed to have ended. So it's not, I think we can get into Canada, okay. But at the moment, I think that might be the nearest we can get to the States. I personally come to the States a lot. And I've got, my daughter lives in Seattle. My eldest son lives in Calgary in Canada. And my other one, my youngest son, lives around London. So, you know, we spread all over the world. So trouble is, somebody's got to go and visit them. It's a terrible thing. You know, you've got to go visit your... Oh, she used to live in Hawaii. My daughter used to live in Hawaii.
Not so terrible at all.
No, it's you know, parental need. You know, you must go see your children, you know. And Hawaii, well, it's a long way away. Well, I'll do it anyway. It doesn't matter.
Nice when you get there. Well, you've been sharing an awful lot of great music behind that drum kit for a long period of time. It's an incredible story. And I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us here on Great Minds.
Okay, man. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Cheers.
For now.
Cheers.